Time to explore the wonderful world of sciences. Only it can be told by the one and only, the wonderful, the amazing, the imaginative, Dr. Carl Krzyzanicki. Good morning to you.
Good morning. You're awfully kind.
What was written down?
And same right back at you.
It was written down. Dr. Carl, we're back to the moon. We talked about the moon and lunar time last week. But now, two bits of the moon, the size of Australia, but hundreds of kilometres high, may well lie 1,400 kilometres underground. It's at the boundary of mantle and the ball of liquid iron inside the Earth. It's under West Africa and the Pacific Ocean. What's this all about, please?
Okay, so what happened was that a big collision formed the moon and left traces deep inside the Earth. Let's go through that one at a time, a big collision. So about 20 to 100 million years after the Earth formed, it got hit by something the size of Mars. So the Earth the Earth was maybe 10,000 kilometers across. And so this thing was moving at, say, 10 kilometers a second. 10,000 divided by 10 gives you 1,000 seconds. That's 20 minutes. So it was a kind of slow motion collision. And it ran into it a bit off center, we think, looking at the simulations and the data. And then formed all this cloud of debris, which eventually coalesced into a long tail coming out of the Earth. And the long tail had two components. It had a big blob that then ended up inside the Earth, turning into these bits of the moon, or what would be the moon, bits of that the size of Australia, and then a bit more of a tail than a smaller blob. That smaller blob coalesced into the moon, and now we're left with the big blob going into the Earth. Now, secondly, let's look at the Earth. So the Earth is a ball today, about 12,000 kilometres across, call it 6,000 kilometres to the centre. Okay, so you've got this thin crust, 6 to 60 kilometres thick, and then reaching roughly halfway down to the centre, you've got this molten, gloopy rock stuff. And then inside that are two balls of iron, a solid ball of iron, and then around that, a liquid ball of iron. And looking at seismic records, you know how you do a CAT scan on a human?
You
aim thousands of X-rays from different angles at a person, and then you solve for that doing simultaneous equations. Do you remember them from school in 1,000 unknowns? And that's why you need a computer to do it. Well, we don't have an X-ray machine big enough to scan the Earth, but the Earth does earthquakes anyway, all by itself. And all we have to do is pick up those recordings of the earthquakes from the thousands of seismic stations that we have around the Earth and feed it into the same program we use for a CAT scanner. And we pick up changes in velocity, and then eventually that gives us the idea of a blob. So there's this big lump from this thing called Theia, that's what they call it, T-H-E-I-A, or nowadays we call what's left over the moon. There's this big lump of Theia. There's one above the central iron just below West Africa, and that kind of makes sense, but the other bit doesn't. They say there's another bit under the Pacific Ocean. Mate, by itself, the Pacific Ocean is bigger than all the land on Earth put together.
Yeah.
And the Pacific Ocean by itself is roughly half the surface of the entire planet. So they're sort of saying it's somewhere over here, you know, sort of stab in the dark, a bit of an arm waving there. But we've been seeing these blobs for a while, and this is the latest theory, but the scientists are quite humble and saying, well, this is what we think. But on the other hand, this is the problem with our data. But so I'm just bringing you up to date with the latest info that we have about the moon.
That is just mind-boggling. My brain's hurting a little bit. So this Theia, which is leftover bits of the moon, if that collision hadn't happened, we wouldn't have the moon as we know it. And what would happen to the development of our atmosphere and the Earth as we know it all these billions of years later?
Well, one thing, that the moon is unusually large and unusually close, and it's both of those at a maximum of all the planets and moons in the solar system. It is the biggest and the closest in terms of being close. Second, our biggest in terms of being a fraction of the size of the mother planet that goes around. Secondly, it tends to keep us pointing upright. You know how the north-south axis of the Earth spins tilted at about 23.5 degrees from the vertical, right? Well, it tends to keep it there. And if it wasn't there, it could flop over on its side, like the planet Uranus has done, with one pole pointing at the sun. And the trouble with that is it makes it hard for life to evolve.
Yeah.
The other thing is that the waves would be a lot less. You'd have a lot less mixing. And the difference between high and low tide would be two-thirds smaller. And so the life would be very, very different from what it evolved into today.
It's just amazing. It's just amazing. So here's your word for the day, folks. Theia. T-H-E-I-A.
Yep.
In other words, leftover bits of the moon.
Oh, well, that was the name of the rock that we've given. That was the rock that ran into us. And about 10% of it formed the moon, and about 90% of it, is sitting on that big liquid iron ball that reaches halfway from the centre up to the surface.
It's just fantastic. Dr. Carl Krzyzelnicki is with us. Dr. Carl, can we go from the moon to fish?
Love fish.
I know you love fish. But how is it that some fish, say for spawning, can adjust from fresh water to salt water or from salt water to fresh water? For example, salmon. That's always fascinated me.
Mm. Yeah, it took me a while to work out when somebody rang in to various radio shows I do and said, "Hey, Dr. Carl, do fish swallow water?" And it took me a long time to get my head around. I had to talk to a few fish experts, or ichthyologists, as they foppishly call themselves. But the way you remember it is S for saltwater fish, S for swallow, and then you go opposite day. So the saltwater fish swallows huge amounts of water, and then, going to opposite days, hardly pees out anything. Most of the water comes out again through its gills. So it comes in through the mouth and out through the gills.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, but here's a bit of background. So fresh water's got no salt. Normal fish, fresh water or salt water, they've got the same roughly amount of salt. And then salt water has got a lot more salt. So fish, whether they're fresh or salt water, are halfway between salt water and saltiness and fresh water. So in fresh water, if you do the old-fashioned chemistry, in salt water, there's an osmotic flow of water out of the body of the fish in a rather futile attempt to dilute the oceans. And so the water comes out through their gills and their skin, and nothing comes out through their urine. And so their kidneys are not doing much work, but they've got special glands in their stomach and in their gills that are doing all sorts of stuff to the salts. With freshwater fish, okay, S for salt, S for swallow. So it's opposite then. So freshwater fish do not swallow any water at all because they've got too much water coming in, straight in. This inward osmotic flow where the fresh water rushes into the body of the fish to try to dilute it. So freshwater fish do not swallow. They don't drink water, but they generate huge amounts of urine. They both have really complicated cell biology happening with regard to dealing with salts and water in their gill and their gut and in their kidneys. And the amazing thing is they can do it sometimes more than once when they go backwards and forwards. So with regard to the eels, they get spawned into the ocean. There's one secret spot off in the Sargasso Sea and another one off the coast of Cairns. And then they make their way inland. They stay inland for about 10 years. And then they go back out to have babies again. And they will slither their way down rivers or across the wet grass on cold nights in an attempt to get to the ocean.
What's also fascinated me is you would have read in the news, heard in the news, that there has been a spate of shark attacks, but bull sharks. And because of all these canals, for example, in Queensland, where we build right on the water, these bull sharks have been known to start in salt water and go way up into fresh water, breed, and then come back into salt water. It's an amazing adaptation, isn't it?
Sharks are pretty good at surviving. They've been around for a couple of hundred million years. And I think in this particular case, evolution got the model right. And once you got it right, there's no real point in changing it.
But we have, look, we're getting onto reptiles now, but saltwater versus freshwater crocodiles. It's another thing. They're reptiles.
Yeah.
It's just fascinating how the earth and how it all works. Dr. Carl Krusinicki, we love you so much. Thank you so much. When's your next public speaking? When can we see you in flesh?
I did one
Tuesday
on the 16th of April, and that was a lot of fun. And I'll be doing a whole lot more when I do my speaking tour for my autobiography coming out on Father's Day this year in September.
In September. Make sure that we here on The Night Shift are informed so that those people that can come and see you, hey?
Yeah, and get interesting stories from the past as well as lots of fun things.
All right, Dr. Carl, always good to talk to you. Thank you for that. Something fishy this morning and something... something a little lunar. Thea, T-H-E-I-A. There's our word for the week. Dr. Carl, love your work.
Love your work and everything you've ever done and everything you ever will do.